have an active shooter. We have an active shooter inside the warehouse.
Welcome to Active Shooter, a podcast that covers the whys, the hows, and the aftermath of active shooter and mass casualty events.
They have an active shooter in the building. A second call says they are being attacked.
I've been shot.
169, Sam Easy, we got shots fired at 415 AS. Route 291, sounded like an automatic firearm.
Active shooter, reports of an active shooter,
active shooter,
active shooter, mass casualty incidents.
Thank you for listening.
You are listening to Active Shooter, a podcast that may contain adult themes, explicit language, and graphic depictions of violence. Portions of this show may be traumatic for those under 18. Listener discretion is advised.
The frantic call to 911 dispatchers came in around 7:30 this morning. Within minutes, officers from Manchester and other surrounding towns, along with the SWAT team, lined up around Hartford Distributors in Manchester.
Couldn't have happened at a worse time of day because you got the third shift going off, the first shift coming on, the office staff there, the sales staff there.
Inside, responding officers found the gunman, an employee of Hartford Distributors, dead after shooting himself. Police say eight others were also shot and killed, allegedly all by...
We appreciate each listener and encourage listener recommendations and will always remain true to our pledge to never name the shooter. And we'll do our best to bring you these cases in the most caring manner that is respectful to those who were injured and lost their lives. Today's shooting at the Hartford Beer Distributors building resulted in a tremendous loss of life, including eight innocent individuals, with two others injured.
Active Shooter, the podcast, is a High Five Holly production, and I'm your host, JT. If you've listened to our prior episodes, you know that the Active Shooter podcast team has taken the No Notoriety Pledge, and we will not be sharing the real name of the shooters that we cover. We will be giving the shooters a pseudonym and refer to them by that name throughout the episode. This will help in clearing up any confusion in the story while remaining true to our pledge in not naming the shooter by their actual name. We will refer to today's shooter as Lee.
Tuesday, August 3rd, 2010, was a typical hot summer day. By 7 a.m., the temperature was already 73 degrees, and it continued to climb. The light, beautiful morning outdoors was a sharp contradiction to the tense, formal meeting that was scheduled to take place at Hartford Beer Distributors, located at 131 Chapel Road in Manchester, Connecticut. The punitory interview was scheduled to begin precisely at 7 a.m., and Lee made it just in the nick of time at 6:59. He was informed about the disciplinary interview the previous day, yet Lee didn't seem concerned about it, at least not according to a coworker. Unfortunately, what that witness was wholly unaware of was the fact that 34-year-old Lee carried two Ruger SR9 automatic pistols, and he intended to kill the people he perceived to play a role in his career decline. What Lee wasn't willing to do was accept his own fault for the reasons he was about to be terminated for. Hartford Beer Distributors was a wholesale distributor of Budweiser products and wine products. The company had surveillance cameras in and around their building, as well as on the delivery trucks that supplied the beer and wine to individual stores. Lee was seen on surveillance stealing beer and empty beer kegs. Management received a tip that Lee was stealing beer from his truck. In order to prove, or even disprove, the information, the company hired a private investigation company called Aegis International The PI firm would follow Lee around to ensure he was making his deliveries as scheduled, and that no product was going unaccounted for. The time and effort hiring the PI firm wasn't wasted. They produced a video that clearly depicted Lee removing cases of beer from a Hartford delivery truck and loading them into a Sean and Christy Quayle's truck. The video then showed Lee driving his delivery truck to a strip mall in East Windsor at the end of his shift on July 16th. Lee can be seen on the video meeting with a man and a woman. He took two kegs from the truck and placed each in the mystery couple's trunk. The man handed Lee something and could be heard saying, quote, "Thank you very much." The private investigators followed the mystery couple to their home, where they were able to obtain the couple's address and eventually their names. A week after that incident, specifically July 23rd, the investigators were again following Lee when he drove to the same strip mall as before. Once again, Lee was observed and recorded loading cases of 30 packs of beer into the trunk of a vehicle driven by the same woman as the week earlier. There didn't appear to be a hand-to-hand cash transaction. However, it was absolutely one half of the same couple that Lee was meeting with before, and there was cash in exchange during that transaction. In total, Lee stole 5 cases of beer and 2 empty kegs, which valued at over $400. It's unknown how much he sold the 2 empty kegs for. Management at Hartford contacted the police, who in turn interviewed the mystery couple that Lee sold the empty kegs and beer to. They claimed to have no idea who Lee was, saying they'd never met him before. The Hartford beer distributor's upper management wasn't about to let Lee off the hook for these incidents. The plan was to end the employment relationship, effective immediately. When Lee arrived at work on Tuesday, August 3rd, he was wearing shorts and a Rocky t-shirt. The meeting commenced with Lee, Executive Vice President and General Manager Steve Hollander, Supervisor Louis Felder, and Union Representative Brian Sirigliano, all present. Lee was presented with the video surveillance that showed him loading cases of beer into the Quayle's truck. Once the video was over, Lee stepped out of the room with his union representative for a few moments before returning, where he was offered 2 options: resign or be fired. Lee opted for the former, though he felt as insulted as if it had been the latter. After signing his resignation paper, which consisted of a single line, Lee was escorted from the room. The entire ordeal lasted about 10 to 15 minutes, and surely the men in the room felt a sense of relief that the meeting went as well as could be expected. Or so it seemed. As they were walking Lee from the building, he asked if he could stop into the kitchen and get a drink of water and his lunchbox. Louis Felder followed Lee into the kitchen, while the other 2 men continued down the hall. Inside the kitchen, Lee proceeded to collect his lunchbox, which contained his 2 Ruger pistols. He slowly drew 1 gun from the lunchbox, turned, and opened fire. Out in the hallway, Steve Hollander heard Louis yelling, "No, you can't," which was followed by a very loud bang. Steve ran towards a nearby office where he heard Union Rep Brian Sirigliano screaming, "No, no," and yet another loud bang. Lee fired his gun at Louis, but the bullet managed to graze Steve Hollander before ultimately killing Louis Felder. There were approximately 50 employees in the building when the shooting started. Steve Hollander ran down a long hallway until he reached another office, which is where he sought shelter. At 7:25 and 38 seconds in the morning, Steve made the first 911 call.
Sir, stay on the line with me.
I'm all over the place.
Okay. How many people got shot?
I don't know.
Okay, you don't know. And you're shot where?
In my head.
You're shot in the head?
Yeah.
And what's your name?
My name is Steve Hollander.
Okay. Who's the person shooting people again?
His name is...
Only 1 second later, another camera showed Douglas Scrudden slumped over on the forklift he operated moments before. He was shot and instantly killed, which caused his foot to fall on the accelerator, which forced the forklift to crash into a wall, tires catching fire after striking an electrical conduit. Lee also shot Victor James in the warehouse, along with Craig Pepin, though neither was captured on video. About 9 seconds after Lee exited the camera's view, Francis Fazio entered camera view. He was running towards the break room, with Lee following him. Francis headed toward the trash compactor, where William Ackerman was working. Lee shot them each 3 times. Lee entered the breakage room next and walked past Aaron Hollander, Steve's son, and then encountered Edwin Kennison, whom he shot in the shoulder. Edwin took off running, and Lee immediately began chasing him. Lee didn't even seem to notice Aaron, though Aaron was standing in plain sight when Lee entered the room. Aaron later reported that when he shot Edwin, Lee was laughing. It was terrifying and chilling. At 7:26 a.m., the surveillance showed Lee still stalking Edwin through the warehouse towards the employee entrance. Both men stumbled outside into the driveway. Another man, Jerome Rosenstein, passed them in a golf cart, and as he was passing, Lee turned and shot him 3 times, never completely breaking stride in pursuit of Edwin. Footage showed the men running when Edwin started running back towards the building. In doing so, he tripped and fell, allowing Lee time to catch up. Edwin proceeded to plead with Lee, begging him not to shoot him. Lee approached, and without uttering a single word, shot Edwin 2 times in the back of the head. Vinicio Herran, an employee with Hartford, was in the parking lot after Lee shot Edwin, and calmly told Lee to put his weapon down. Lee ignored him and walked past the main entrance, entering through the employee entrance. He walked to the main office, and then walked into Julie Klusick's office. Julie is wheelchair-bound, as she suffers from multiple sclerosis, and Lee could see as much when he walked into her office. He seemed surprised and exclaimed, "You're in a wheelchair," before walking back out of her office. Julie watched in what could only be a dreadful combination of fear, panic, and relief as Lee walked into the office's reception area. The lobby door locks when a person leaves the reception area, so Lee shot out the glass of the door to the main office so he could regain entry to the building from the lobby. He had left his lunchbox in another office and had held his second gun. So this was where Lee was intent on getting next. He entered the office and grabbed the backup gun, and then walked into Linda Davidson's office where he locked the door behind him. Between 7:32 and 7:42 a.m., Lee called his mom 3 times, using Linda's cell phone. At 7:55 a.m., he called 911 and spoke to Connecticut State Trooper William Taylor for approximately 4 minutes. Shortly after that, at 8:06 a.m.,
State Police.
Hey, 911.
Yeah, can I help you?
The shooter over in Manchester.
Yes, where are you, sir?
I'm in the building. You probably want to know the reason why I shot this place up. This place here is a racist place.
Yep, I understand that.
Yeah, they treat me bad over here, and treat all the black employees bad over here, too. So I take it to my own hands and handle the problem. I wish I could have got more of the people.
Yeah. Are you armed, sir? Do you have a weapon with you?
Oh, yeah, I'm armed.
How many guns do you have with you?
I got one now. This one out, in the, factory there.
Yep. Okay, sir.
I'm not going to kill nobody else, though.
Yeah. We're going to have you surrender yourself somehow here. Not make the situation any worse, you know what I mean?
These cops are going to kill me.
No, they're not. We're just going to have to get you to relax.
I'm back to calm down.
To have you, you know, turn yourself over.
Yeah. You can be popular. You can play this on the news. You can be popular right here, man. Make sure you say the right thing. Hey, there's a spot team just rode by in army gear. They don't know where I'm at, but I don't know. Maybe you can chase it from this phone call. But yeah, these people here are crazy in this building. They treat me bad since I started here, a racist company.
Yep.
Treat me bad. I'm the only black driver they got here.
Okay,
they treat me bad over here. Treat me bad all the time.
This is a horrible situation. I understand that.
Hey, don't try to calm me down. I'm already calm down.
Yeah.
I'm not going to kill anybody else. I just want to tell my story so you can
Okay.
Stay back anyway.
Then you're gonna help me get you out of the building, okay?
right, I'm good. I don't care. Don't worry about it. Already. I got that taken care of. Now, anybody talk to me to get me out of the building?
Where in the building are you?
I'm not going to tell you that. When they find me, that's when everything will be over. But
yeah. Just, you know, where are you located? Are you up in the offices?
When they find me, everything will be all right. Especially Manchester itself is a racist place.
Yeah. Now, what time did you get there today?
About 7 o'clock.
Yeah?
Yeah.
This morning?
Yeah, about 7 a.m., yeah.
Yeah.
You're coming from early today.
What type of weapon do you have?
I got a Ruger SR9.
A Ruger?
Yeah.
SR9?
Automatic, yeah.
Is it a rifle?
No, no, that's a pistol. Nice pistol, too, one of my favorites.
Now, you're going to make the troopers and the people come in and get you? You're not going to surrender yourself?
Well, I guess, maybe I'll surrender. Nah, they're coming to get me. They're coming to get me.
Yeah, we wouldn't want to do it like that.
Yeah.
You know, it's already been a bad enough scene here this morning. We want you to relax. Now,
I'm relaxed, though. I'm calm down now.
We don't want any more people to lose their life here.
I'm not going to kill nobody else.
Yeah. Okay.
I'm not coming out where I'm at. I'm not coming out there to find me. Alright, so some dogs or whatever. I don't know what he do. Anyway.
17 shots. How much ammunition you have with you?
I got a lot of shots left. Oh.
What's that?
Alright. I guess this conversation is over. I have to take care of business. Got my people, but I love them.
Yeah.
And I gotta go now. Yeah.
I really want you to help me stop this situation. Okay?
Okay.
If you work with me, we'll get this to stop. Okay? Boom. Okay. He's still alive. I'm alive.
Active shooter, reports of an active shooter,
active shooter,
active shooter with mass casualty incidents.
Active shooter, reports of an active shooter,
active shooter,
active shooter with mass casualty incidents.
Police surround the office and holler for Lee to come out with his hands up. In an anxious tone of voice, Lee calls out several times that he is coming out. Yet he never does. Minutes later, the police heard what they described as a muffled popping sound. Three teams of police units entered the building at 8:12 a.m. and located Lee in a corner office on the southwest end of the building. He was dead from a self-inflicted gunshot wound to the back right side of his head. Lee was actively shooting for about 3 minutes total. Police responded very quickly after the first 911 call and entered the building less than an hour later. One of the first officers to respond discovered a person laying at the front door entrance of the facility. The person was gravely injured, so the police officer picked the man up and placed him on the hood of his patrol vehicle and drove, carefully, to get medical attention for the man. Employees ran in every direction. They ran for their lives. Some fled to the parking lot and hid underneath cars. Others ran into the nearby woods, seeking shelter behind trees and anything else that would obscure them from view. Steve described Lee later as being, quote, cold as ice, and calm as he walked through the building, shooting and killing innocent people as they worked. Later, the bomb squad arrived and swept Lee's car, locating no explosive devices, though they did find another firearm, a rifle. A family reunification center was established at Manchester High School, as it was closed for the summer break, leaving it free of vulnerable students. Police called in chaplains, staff from Manchester Memorial Hospital, a critical stress debriefing team, and the social service department. Emergency responders from East Hartford, Vernon, Newington, South Windsor, and the state police responded without being asked. There was a terrifying emergency situation. And that was what they signed up to do. Serve and protect, no questions asked. Brian Sirigliano, Lee's union rep, had a bad feeling before that meeting. He even confessed to his brother the night before the shooting that he was concerned and was anxious about it. He was apprehensive, yet he still showed up, ready to be a representation for Lee's own interests. Witnesses report that Lee was eerily cool. He never shouted or yelled, and in fact, rarely spoke any words at all. He never protested in the meeting or expressed any type of feelings or tried to contest the findings of the company, but rather seemed to accept the terms of his resignation well enough. Before the self-inflicted gunshot, a police sharpshooter just received approval to fire on Lee. However, he never got the chance before Lee took his own life. Many believe that the majority of those he killed were purposely sought out by Lee, murdered with forethought and malice. He appeared to pass right over certain people, literally allowing them to live because he didn't choose to execute them on sight. As is the case in nearly every shooting we've covered, the scene was utter mayhem. The building was large, and there were massive stacks of liquor and beer cartons that created makeshift hallways.
We're told he was given an option to either resign or be terminated. He was being escorted from the building when the shots rang out.
The 9mm handguns and shotgun were believed to have been purchased at Hoffman's Gun Center in East Windsor, and were bought legally and through the proper channels. As one of the newest drivers for Hartford, Lee knew that 7 o'clock a.m. was the busiest time of day, when each of the office staff was in for the day, and the warehouse day shift was beginning. After the shooting, two detectives arrived at Lee's apartment looking for him, but found his girlfriend instead. She sent two text messages to Lee, asking, quote, "Why are two detectives at my door? And are you okay?" Lee never responded to either, and when his girlfriend saw the news, she collapsed to the ground, in complete shock that her boyfriend could do such a thing.
He started in an office area where they had a disciplinary hearing. After that, he was escorted out of that meeting after he tendered his resignation. He briefly stopped in a kitchen area where he said he wanted a drink of water, which is also where he had his lunchbox hidden. At that point, he went into the kitchen area, got his lunchbox with the weapons inside, exited the kitchen area, and then started shooting as soon as he got into the hallway. From the hallway, he went through like an office complex, and then went into a large warehouse area where there were some other additional victims there. He then chased one or more victims through the building and out into the parking lot before re-entering the building itself, walking back in. He was unable to get in because it was a locked door, so he was able to shoot through the glass and open the door to get back into the building. And then he continued to walk through the building where we found other victims. And then said he was finally located in a southwest corner office, deceased. He didn't have a master list that we found or anything saying that these are the people that he was going to go after, but based upon some of the people that were victims, it's probably likely that he was targeting some individuals. He passed by other individuals and did not shoot them.
57-year-old Francis Fazio Sr. was born on September 3rd, 1952 in Waterbury, Connecticut. Those that knew him referred to him as Fran. A lifelong resident of Bristol, Connecticut, Fran married the love of his life, Patricia, and was a hard-working man who had been with Hartford Beer Distributors for 28 years. Fran was a proud member of the St. Stanislaus Church and was described as a devoted husband and doting father. Fran risked his life to warn others about the shooting, and while his two children, son Francis Jr. and daughter Gina, must grow up without their beloved father, he died a hero, and someone they could regard as such forever. Francis Fazio Sr. will be greatly missed. Douglas Scruton was born on April 5, 1954, and was only 56 years old when he was senselessly murdered. A dedicated employee of Hartford for over 30 years, Douglas attended school in the local Manchester School District and was a lifelong Manchester resident until he moved to Middleton just before the shooting. He loved to travel with his wife, Mikkel, particularly to the White Mountains in New Hampshire and Hawaii, which were their favorite places. Douglas was also an avid sports enthusiast who was passionate about duckpin bowling and especially loved the Red Sox, New England Patriots, and all UConn sports teams. Those who knew Douglas said he was a gentle soul and loved nature. He helped animals and was a true friend to many. Douglas will never be forgotten. 49-year-old Edwin Kennison was the youngest of the victims. He went by Eddie and was also a huge sports nut. Eddie was a big fan of the New York Yankees and the Dallas Cowboys, as well as Syracuse University athletic teams. He was born in Hartford, Connecticut, and graduated from Manchester High School in 1980. In 1979, Eddie played in the boys' state soccer tournament and was even named MVP. He was very active in youth sports and was the coach for a few teams. Eddie loved playing, too, and was a member of several softball teams, which took up much of his time when he wasn't busy umpiring games. He collected sports memorabilia as well, and you could pretty much sum up that most of Eddie's life revolved around sports. His truest love, though, was his little girl, Ashley. Eddie will be deeply mourned by the sports community and so many others that he devoted himself to. William Ackerman was born in Hackensack, New Jersey, on January 23, 1959. He graduated from Enfield High School, where he was a well-known athlete who played baseball, football, and hockey. William loved gardening, too, along with golfing and hiking. If it was an outdoor activity, chances are William was into it. He was an avid Boston Red Sox fan, but also rooted for the Dallas Cowboys and UConn football. He lived in Manchester for much of his life, until about 3 years before the shooting when he moved to Broadbrook. William is survived by his best friend and partner Stephanie, and three children, Daniel, Nicholas, and Melissa, and they will miss him so much. 51-year-old Brian Sirigliano was born on November 9, 1958, in Newington, Connecticut, where he lived for most of his life. Brian worked at Hartford for 29 years and spent many of those years coaching his daughters in fast-pitch softball. He married his soulmate, Patricia, and they shared 28 years of wedded bliss before his murder. Brian is described as the consummate family man, who was devoted to his wife and daughters, Lindsay and Megan. He was a hard-working man who cared deeply for those in his life, and his loss will be keenly felt. Craig A. Pepin was born on February 24, 1950, and was only 60 years old when he was murdered. Craig lived in South Windsor for over 29 years and worked at Hartford for 35. A parishioner of St. Margaret Mary Church in South Windsor, Craig also served on the parish council. He attended Bolton High School, where he played baseball, basketball, and soccer, before going on to the University of Bridgeport, where he was the goalie for the soccer team. Later, Craig coached baseball, basketball, and soccer for 25 years, and was a huge Mets and UConn basketball fan. Craig leaves behind his loving children, Kristen, Kevin, Mark, and Ryan, and will be missed more than words can describe. 50-year-old Louis Felder was lovingly referred to as Big Louie. He was a big guy, but he was known for having a bigger heart. A native of Oceanside, New York, Louis attended the Hebrew Academy of Long Beach for elementary school, and then graduated high school from Hillel School in Windmere, where he played basketball. Louis was known for his strength of character, and was a very reliable person. In high school, he went to Jerusalem to study for 2 years before he attended Queens College. Louis met his wife, Helena, and the couple moved to Connecticut, though Louis was a true New Yorker through and through. People would sometimes comment, Louis never wore jackets or coats, preferring sweaters instead. He was an emotional man that had a massive heart, and those are precisely the traits that will make Louis so dearly missed. He is survived by his wife, Helena, and their three children, Gabriel, Samantha, and Stephanie. 61-year-old Victor James was born on August 30th, 1949, in Providence, Rhode Island. but moved to Connecticut when he was a teenager. Called Vic by those who knew him, Vic was a family man who loved his grandchildren, who affectionately called him G. Vic worked at Hartford for 30 years and is survived by his daughters Darlene and Denise and 4 grandchildren. The loss of Vic will be felt immensely. Hartford Distribution is a family owner's business that frequently sponsors local sports teams of all ages. Incorporated in 1944, the company relocated headquarters twice in East Hartford before moving to the current location in Manchester in 1981. Hartford currently operates in 6 counties and covers over 3/4 of the state with a variety of brands under their umbrella. Hartford Distributors had never had a complaint filed against them at the time of the shooting, which is according to the Connecticut Commission on Human Rights and Opportunities.
Active shooter, reports of an active shooter,
active shooter,
active shooter, mass casualty incidents.
Active shooter, reports of an active shooter,
active shooter,
active shooter, mass casualty incidents.
Little information could be obtained on the shooter. He was mostly quiet and kept to himself. He had a minimal criminal record except for 2 speeding tickets, which were received in February of 2007 and December of 2008. As a result of the speeding tickets, within only a few years, the DMV suspended his commercial driver's license for 3 months. The shooter attended Manchester High School and graduated from East Hartford High School. According to an obituary posted online, the shooter received a nurse aid certificate from Connecticut Department of Public Health, as well as phlebotomy skills for healthcare personnel from Naugatuck Valley Community College. He had 6 guns registered in his name, along with a pistol permit, and he had plans to teach his little daughter how to shoot one day. His daughter was his everything to him, in addition to his fiancée, whom he had been living with for the last 8 years. The couple frequently discussed starting a family of their own, which seemed to be something that the shooter truly desired. Those who were close enough to him claim that the shooter was a, quote, mama's boy, who never smoked or drank and was laid back and mild-mannered. Some said that the shooter was a hard worker, and his fiancée's mother said he was an easygoing guy who enjoyed playing video games and sports. His girlfriend claims that the job at Hartford was the shooter's dream job, one he had been trying to land for about 18 months. In the early aughts, the shooter filed for bankruptcy, and in 2000 he listed assets on a petition of $4,850, which included a 1994 Chrysler Concord. He claimed to have over $15,000 in liabilities that included credit card and student loan debts. At the time he filed, the shooter was working as a driver for Stericycle in Middleton, which was a medical and hazardous waste disposal company. In March of 2001, his debts were discharged, and the case was officially closed in April. On the work front, it appears that the shooter never filed any complaints with his union. In fact, the only complaint he ever filed was when he asked to be promoted from an entry-level job to a driver. The union lawyer said that because of seniority, he would need to wait until another spot opened up. He was promoted about a year later. He was aware of the grievance protocol, yet failed to follow through with any formal complaints. Despite the lack of formal complaints, the shooter did claim, at least to his fiancée, that he was racially harassed at work. He claimed that there was once a photo of a noose in his locker and a racial slur was scribbled on the bathroom wall, which his family says pushed the shooter over the edge. He didn't file a complaint with the union regarding racism, and he didn't report anything to a coworker or the police. His mother, fiancé, and fiancé's mother each were aware of the racist allegations, and on the morning of the shooting, his fiancé could tell that something was off with him. She knew about the meeting and couldn't help but note the confused and slightly dazed look on his face that morning. She claims to have asked the shooter multiple times what, if anything, was wrong, but he continuously said nothing was wrong. He hugged and kissed her before leaving, saying he would call her later. It was a call that would never be made.
When he was leaving, he gave me a really, really big hug and kiss that I've never really gotten like that before. And I kept asking him what was wrong, and I gave him another kiss and hug out at his car, and then he drove away, and then I found out about everything on the news.
It was later alleged that the shooter's fiancée complained about racism to several people, yet nothing was ever done about it. Despite this, every single employee, along with numerous other witnesses, were interviewed by the police, and there was not one single report of the shooter ever discussing racial issues. It must be noted that the racism the shooter experienced in no means provides any kind of excuse, or makes it less tragic or traumatizing. However, it may help to provide some insights as to how and why the shooter escalated as he did. After all, many people that encounter racism, sexism, and harassment of any kind are reluctant to come forward and report their story. Still, there is no excuse for the horrendous actions of this man. Christy Quayle was charged with theft 3 days after the shooting. Her husband previously was employed by Hartford Beer Distributors as well, though it's unclear how or why the couple became connected with the shooter. The shooter's fiancé claims that he told her about contacting his union rep several times about filing a complaint. However, the union rep strongly denies this. A full investigation was conducted after the shooting, and it was determined that there was no evidence of racist behavior or activity uncovered. We all have the unique ability to help prevent such a catastrophic event from happening, if we keep our eyes and ears open, and never hesitate to report when something or someone just doesn't seem right. It is our sincerest wish that there will be no more active or mass shooting stories to tell. We pray that love will prevail over hate.
Too many have died! We should say to ourselves, not one more!
In the meantime, we urge our listeners to stay aware of your surroundings and keep in touch with your loved ones. If you see something, say something. You never know how many lives you'll be saving.
Thank you for listening to today's episode of Active Shooter, the podcast. Remember, if you see something, say something. There's no telling how many lives you may be saving. A huge thank you to Darren Curtis, who composed some of the music used in this episode. Check him out at darrencurtismusic.com. DarrenCurtis. Music.com.
Active shooter. Reports of an active shooter. Active shooter.
Active shooter. Mass casualty incidents.
Make sure to check us out on social media. We have a discussion group on Facebook. Just search for Active Shooter, the podcast discussion group. You can also find us on Instagram at Active the Podcast and Twitter at Podcast Active. For just $1 a month, you can get access to ad-free episodes, early release episodes when available, and a shout-out on the show. Just go to patreon.com/activethepodcast. Thank you, and be safe.